he doesn't want it to work.
Okay. Look at that. Okay. Questions? The mind, the brain.
Yeah, the mind lets you bring it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure this is a question, but what I'll do is try to describe a hypothesis, and you tell me if I'm absolutely insane. Okay. So listening to your multiple lectures, you don't, it's funny, because you like to do this and harp on a scientist, and it's no problem with scientists. And I agree. Okay, there can be bad scientists, for sure, and there can be a lot of them. But you've never said anything against the scientific method itself, right? And I think, and I'm proposing, that you see that the scientific method has its value, okay? And if you want to go into what value is, I refer you to many books. But it has some value. Why? Because it helps to model what we see as the physical world, what we experience as the physical world, right? So here's my hypothesis. Okay, I'm gonna use some labels, and I'm going to rearrange them. Put it in a Jewish context. Let's go first. There's reality. And we understand reality, we break it down into two abstract pieces. Number one, a physical world. So reality, physical world. Number two is a spiritual world. And we propose that there is a connection between the two. Okay, and we ourselves experience this as mind. Okay? Now our model of physical reality is scientific method. This is how we explain what we experience around us. Okay? And it's falling apart when it's trying to explain the spiritual world. Okay? The second piece of what we say is part of reality. Okay? Because we don't understand this connection between the two of them. Okay? We know the spiritual world influences the physical world, we think. And we think the physical world influences the spiritual world. Okay? So, what we need is a correct model of the spiritual world to be analogous to the scientific method. Okay? So now let me rearrange the label and put it in the Jewish context. Okay? We, as physical beings, have a problem experiencing the spiritual world. Why? Because we're physical beings. We're really rooted into this physical world. Let me rearrange the labels now. Replace the word reality with the idea, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, okay? And realize that the connection between the spiritual world and the physical world is the Torah. Okay? It is the translation mechanism between one and the other, how we experience the spiritual world. So the reality then is, reality is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and what we call the physical world in this abstraction of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is really that there is no, that distinction between reality and the physical world and the spiritual world actually doesn't exist. It's more than something. Okay. It's only in that translation that we get confused.
There is a great deal of merit in what you say. There's a great deal of merit in what you say. Indeed, I think you have diagnosed me correctly. I do talk about scientists, and I talk about scientific beliefs. I have not said anything about the scientific method. I think it's a very sharp observation. It's an accurate observation. Because, in some sense, I do want to support rational investigation. Let's put it that way. Rational investigation and theorizing and analysis, gathering of evidence, whether you should call it the scientific method or not, maybe it's not maybe a little prejudicial, but yes, I do want to support a method. So I think you're generally right about that. And I don't want to go into precise definitions of all the terms and picking apart the exact relationships. I think there's a great deal of merit in what you say. Let me try to say a few words to orient how I see the picture, but I think you've done really a quite remarkable job of trying to put this together. It's very interesting. I came across an influential book by Noam Chomsky less than a year ago. He says that the difficulty about relating the mind to the brain or the mind to the physical world is we don't know what physical means anymore. Let alone the mind, which is hard enough. We don't have any grasp of what physical is supposed to be. When you say physical, I guess you think of billiard balls. and pebbles and mountains and water and gas. What about magnetism? Is that part of the physical world? You can't push a magnetic field. You can't see a magnetic field. You can't feel a magnetic field. It's just sort of there. Well, not with your direct senses, you can't. Not the field. The field is pervasive. It's all pervasive. Magnetism and electricity are just two aspects of the same phenomenon. You know, electromagnetic fields that are coursing through our bodies at this very moment, and we don't feel them. Furthermore, these fields spread throughout all of space, and they spread throughout all of space at the speed of light. That's not exactly like a billiard ball anymore. And then there's something called energy. In addition to mass, and no, science has not discovered that everything's really energy. It's, you know, people who like to mystify themselves and confuse everyone say, no, what they've discovered is that energy can be changed into mass, and mass can be changed into energy back and forth. So you might just as well say that everything's really mass, or everything's really energy, or say the truth, which is, you can convert the one into the other interchangeably. Well, and then there's some part of the world which is what it is only when you look at it. And when you're not looking, it isn't that way. And that's very strange. And that's all supposed to be part of the physical world. Says Chomsky, we don't know what physical means anymore. We don't have a category of things, all of which are essentially the same. I put everything in that bag and say, well, this is the physical stuff. And other things aren't like that. Because, frankly, there's no limit on what we'll call physical. Until 1965, the most popular theory of how the world works was that everywhere in the universe, new stuff is popping into existence out of nothing all the time. That was called the steady state theory. It's popping into existence out of nothing all the time, regularly. About one electron per cubic meter of space per century. That was the rate at which this stuff was coming into existence, out of nothing, forever. The universe is infinitely big, infinitely old, infinitely the same, always the same. Sure, it's growing everywhere. It's infinite, so why can't it grow? It just grows everywhere. I think it's not getting farther apart, because more new stuff is coming up in between everything all the time. And that's the way it is, always has been and always will be. So, we've lost our grasp of what science is talking about. Roughly, what's accepted as physical is whatever science talks about. Whatever it might be. And whether it has a size and a weight, whether it's static or growth, whether it's there when you're looking or there when you're not looking, that's up to science to describe, to decide. So when faced with this problem, some people retreat and say, well, you know what the physical world is? It's whatever science will really say is there when science gets finished. Trouble is, no one knows what science is going to be talking about when it gets finished. Superstrings, maybe? Point particles? Logic? Who knows? So, if you talk about reducing the mind to the physical, you don't know what the physical is you're supposed to be reducing it to. For example, we talk about reducing chemistry to physics. Now, chemistry is really nothing but physics. You know, chemistry is just lots and lots of physical things going on in a big bunch. But the only way you ended up reducing chemistry to physics by inventing quantum mechanics, which radically changed what physics is. So is that really a reduction? It's not a reduction to billiard balls. That won't do it. You can't make chemistry work with billiard balls. You can only make chemistry work with weird quantum effects. So yeah, you reduced it. You reduced it by taking the thing you're doing the reduction with and changing it into something else. Is that really a reduction? You know, who's influencing who here? Are we discovering that chemistry is really physics? Or looking at chemistry, are we saying, we've got to really change physics, because otherwise it's not going to work. So we change physics. So who's running the show here? Is physics running the show or chemistry running the show? It's a real confusion. It's a real confusion. What I think really we have to do, and the words I'm going to say now are so general that they have no content, but that's really the message. What we really have to do is open up our eyes and look at everything equally, and try to figure out what we know here, what we know there. This is what Chomsky really says. And Chomsky's anti-religious, so you can trust everything he says. He's really scientific, really objective, really well thought out. You know, if you're religious, then of course it would be just mush. But he's anti-religious.
No one is objective.
Just fighting the certain prejudices here. He says, look, take a look at what you know. Take a look at what you see. Work on local projects. Try to understand things in their own terms as best you can. And then with an open mind, try to chart the relationships of one thing to another. And see where you get. But to start with a prejudice, tables are really real. And anything that isn't like a table isn't really real. That's just a prejudice. Why should you think that way? Certainly, my experience of heat is as real to me as the table is, maybe more so. I could imagine at the far distant reaches of my imagination discovering that tables were an illusion. Very difficult for me to discover that my feeling of heat is an illusion. What else would it be? It's a feeling after all, right? How could I be fooled into thinking I'm feeling heat when I'm not really feeling heat? People have worked on that, but it's much harder to work on than tables. So, just start with everything you have. Start with the things that you experience, the things that you feel you know. Chart each one. Yeah, how did Chomsky get into this? Because in his discussion of language, he wanted to talk about a person following rules without his knowing that he's doing it. And people jumped on him and said, what, unconsciously following rules? It's a contradiction in terms. To follow a rule means you know what you're doing, and it's capable of self-criticism and so forth and so on. He said, listen, if it works, it works. Don't saddle me with your prejudices from your project. You know, little kids will say, he brang it. Why? Because brang is parallel to other verbs. And they just think that to bring must be brang, like to sing, to sang, and so they make it parallel. Now, Chomsky says, what we say about them is, they're unconsciously following a rule to make the verbs work the same, and they have to be taught that this is an exception to the rule. And when philosophers say to Chomsky, what do you mean, unconsciously following a rule? He says, look, I'm describing it. Does it make sense? Does it fit? Will it predict what they do? Then it's good enough. It isn't your sense of rule, so there's no sense of rule. Don't stop me from describing what I see in the best, most useful, productive ways to describe it. And if it doesn't fit your reductions, maybe so much the worse for your reductions. Or maybe like physics, you'll have to change what you're reducing it to. I don't know. Don't be prejudiced in the absent. Don't use a philosophical position to stop honest inquiry into any subject that comes your way. Now, the same is true with conscious experience. It is ABCs to every unprejudiced human being that he has conscious experience. Even though there are some philosophers who want to say that it's an illusion, but it's very difficult to make out how my feeling of pain or my experience of music or my worries and anxieties are not real. And if it doesn't fit into your physical world, be honest, admit it, and just try to deal with it somehow. And if you can't deal with it, admit that you can't deal with it. Don't use a philosophical prejudice to somehow override the phenomena that are right in front of your face.
Yeah. You were talking about like the scientific method, and maybe you can back this up or criticize, but isn't all scientific, not all, but I'm not, that's a too broad a statement, but a lot of scientific method of some of the major discoveries, including like caloric theory when it was discovered, that they're based on something that's in logic is illogical, like it's not a valid argument, which is that A therefore B, and then B therefore we have A. So for example, we come up with a theory, the caloric theory of heat. Okay, so we say if the wood reacts like we think it's going to react in our theory, like the wood will get hot, then it's the caloric theory of heat. Sorry. If it's the caloric theory of heat that's true, then the wood will react a certain way. The wood reacted a certain way, therefore it's the caloric theory of heat that's causing that. And that instead of A therefore B, A therefore B, it's the other way around.
If you are trying to demonstrate that something is true, then the scientific method isn't going to help you. That's quite right. If your model for thought is deductive logic, science isn't going to help you. If I have a theory, how do I test it? I make a prediction. The prediction comes true. What do I conclude? I can prove the theory is true? No, for sure not. That would be confusing science with deduction. But what you say is, I have evidence that the theory is true. That's not a mistake. It is evidence. If the caloric theory is correct, the body ought to behave this way. It behaves that way. That's evidence that it's true. Some things for which we have evidence turn out to be wrong. That doesn't mean that there's no evidence.
Yes, but it's not a logic. It's not a true logical statement.
Well, it's not deductive logic. It's not deductive logic.
It's not inductive.
Well, of course, that's what we're trying to do, is develop what's called inductive logic. Now, inductive logic is a much worse shape than deductive logic. The canons that people try to invent didn't turn out to work, but it's a subject, and it's not a non-subject, and it's not just that they made a mistake because they got it wrong deductively. They're working on a different subject.
Right.
They're working on a different subject. Now, let me tell you, because you will come across this probably subject you have, and this will be important for us when we talk about the evidence for Judaism. There was a fellow, a Jew, named Popper, Karl Popper, Sir Karl Popper. He was knighted by the British Empire for his services to philosophy. Turns out that deserves a knighthood. But he wrote some very influential books in philosophy, science, and in social theory. So one of the major 20th century philosophers. Now, here's what he said. With respect to science and philosophy, one of his most famous contributions, and I think it's probably the piece of philosophy that more scientists know than any other piece of philosophy. Here's what he said. Here's how science works. You have things you want to explain. So you think of a theory. You test the theory by asking the theory to make a prediction. So you think about the theory and analyze how it would apply and say, well, if the theory's true, then X ought to happen. So then you test, see whether X happens. If X doesn't happen, then you have proved the theory wrong. You made the prediction, and the prediction didn't come true, so you proved it wrong. If X does happen, as he points out, you can prove the theory is right, the theory has survived a test. And then you make another prediction. You keep making predictions. As long as the predictions come true, the theory survives the test, and you maintain it. When you come to a false prediction, then the theory has failed. You junk it and get a new theory. That's the method of science. You have a theory, make a prediction. If the prediction comes out wrong, the theory is proven wrong, get another theory. Comes out right, passes the test, and goes to the next prediction. That's how science works. Which means, says Popper, the first step in framing a theory, in creating a theory, in defining a theory is, show me how it makes predictions that could prove it wrong. You must be able to make predictions which can be checked, which, if they come out wrong, will prove the theory is wrong. This is called falsifiability. Falsifiability. The theory must be falsifiable. What does that mean? It doesn't mean the theory's got to be something you can prove false. That would be a waste of time. If they can prove it false, forget it and get another one. No, it means that someone who proposes the theory owes us. He owes us a picture of how it makes a prediction and how, when you check the prediction, it could go wrong. It doesn't have to go wrong, but it could go wrong. And if it goes wrong, the theory will be wrong. If somebody proposes a theory, and that theory is immune from tests, meaning there's nothing that could prove it wrong, then that's not science. Science is saying things that could go wrong. If you concoct something which can't go wrong, then it is inherently not science. And not only is it not science, but he will say it has no real content, it has no real meaning, it has no real truth value, it's not really true or false, it's just metaphysics, by which they meant junk, garbage. Metaphysics was the code word for garbage. So again, here's the criterion. Somebody proposes a statement for us to think about. We say to him, tell me, how could it be proven wrong? We don't know if it will be proven wrong, but at least it's got to be the possibility of proving it wrong. If it's impossible to prove it wrong, so then it's not a matter for discussion or rational inquiry or for scientific method. It's something which isn't worthy of consideration at all. People in metaphysics say things like, love is beautiful.
Uh-huh.
Right. So now, what tests could I possibly use to show that it's wrong? There's nothing that possibly shows that it's wrong. Then it's fluff. It's just talk without meaning, talk without content, talk without any application. And you just forget it. And this was the critique of religion. This was the critique of religion. Because you say there's a God. All right, what could I do to prove it wrong? What experiment could I do? What observation could I make? What test could there be that would make you give it up? Nothing, because God is infinite, because God can be behind you, because God could fool you. If so, you propose something that can't be tested. If it can't be tested, it's not science, it's not reason, it's not rational, it's not, has no content, it's something which you just throw in the garbage bin. The whole idea was to create a way of distinguishing between statements that have real content, really describe the world, really are the matter that science should be dealing with, on the one hand, and nonsense on the other hand. This was the verificationist criterion of meaning, of which Parker was one of the great advocates. Now, you talk to scientists, and if they know any philosophy at all, they definitely know this. This is how science works. This is what science does. And if you have an idea which can't be proven wrong, it's impossible to prove wrong, then it's not worthy of any scientific consideration or any rational consideration. That is Popper's position. The tragedy is that Popper's position is dead wrong. And has known to be wrong for at least 60 years. When I went to graduate school, we had all the lists of things that are wrong with Popper's theory. It just hasn't gotten out to the public, in particular, hasn't gotten out to the scientific public. They're going to read philosophy. They read science. That's their job. But it has been known to be wrong. One good place to see a summary of the problems of this theory is a book called Philosophy of Biology by Elliot Sober, published by Oxford. There's a whole section on Popper. Sober, S-O-B-E-R. One of the best people writing philosophy of biology. I've learned a great deal from his books. He's very, very good.
He's what university? Like, he's from Oxford.
No, he is from the University of Indiana, I believe, but this book is published by Oxford. Now, here's a very simple counterexample. This was Rudolf Carnap's counterexample. I'm going to give you a hypothesis. And I claim that it is a bona fide scientific hypothesis. And it definitely would be accepted and should be accepted in any scientific worldview as a hypothesis. Hypothesis worthy of thinking about, worthy of taking seriously, worthy of investigation. Okay? Here it is. Somewhere in the universe, past, present, or future, there is a unicorn. Somewhere in the universe, past, present, or future, there's a unicorn. Okay, let's think. Could this be tested? Is there an experiment we could do to prove it wrong? Some observation we could make to prove it wrong? Some test, which if it came out badly, would prove that it's wrong? What would it be? How would we test? Set up a test and say, here's the test, and it comes out like this, we proved it wrong. That somewhere in the universe, past, present, and future, there's a unicorn. What do? Search the whole universe? Past, present, and future? That's not in the cards, boys and girls. Especially the past. So it definitely doesn't fit Popper's criteria. It doesn't pass Popper's test. Is it really a bona fide scientific hypothesis? Sure, because you could prove it true with one observation. Find a unicorn. And you would know it's true. Anything that can be proved true by observation certainly deserves to be taken seriously by science. And it can't be falsified. So Popper's just wrong. Now, Sober does this trick with a little more sophistication. He says, you take any proposition, if you accept that it is a scientific proposition, then its denial also ought to be scientific. You're not going to distinguish and say, this proposition is a scientific proposition, but the denial of the proposition is not. If it has content, the denying it just denies that content. It should also have content. Now, You take any universal proposition,
right?
Take the denial of it. There is no unicorn. There are no unicorns anywhere in the universe. That is easy to falsify. If you find one, you prove it's false. So, there are no unicorns, you can't falsify. There is a unicorn, you can't falsify. That doesn't mean that one of them is really scientific and the other one isn't. One's just the denial of the other. That's not the only problem. There are many other problems with this idea. One of the problems is this. Take any theory that has passed all its tests so far. It is easy to concoct an infinity of competing theories, all of which have passed all the same tests, but will make different predictions for the future. Do you really need to tell me, Sir Carl, that all these infinity of theories are all equally good? If so, then we have no way of predicting for the future. Here's how you do it. I don't know if you've heard of this problem, the curve-fitting problem. You're trying to pick up a hypothesis that explains data. Data is what you get from experiments. You never have more than an infinite number of experiments. You can't do an infinity of experiments. Each experiment gives you a piece of data which can be represented as a point on a graph. Your theory is how you connect the points on the graph. How do you connect the points? Well, you just choose a kind of smooth curve to go through the points. We told you to use a smooth curve. Maybe you use a bumpy curve. Or a wavy curve. Sine curve, cosine curve, you know, anything you like. If all you're doing is testing your theory with observations, all the curves fit equally all the observations we have. That's all you're doing. Then you have no way to choose between the smooth curve and the bumpy curve. If the whole of the scientific method is just to test, and all you can say for your theory that has passed all the tests that we've given it so far, then you have to face the fact there's an infinity of other theories that have passed all the tests you've given so far also. We don't operate like that. We use something called simplicity. Simplicity is a brand new feature that Popper doesn't describe. This picture has no use for simplicity. A third problem. You never test the theory by itself. You always test the theory together with myriads of other assumptions. My theory is that this star is going to explode. So when I look for it tomorrow night, it shouldn't be there. That's my theory. Okay, so I look for it. How do I look for it? I use a telescope. Where do I point the telescope? Well, to where the star ought to be. And how do I know the telescope is pointing in that direction? Well, I have magnets, and I have my geometry, and I have the machine that points it. Right? And when should I look? At 6 o'clock. How do I know when it's 6 o'clock? I look at my watch. So I've got the telescope and theories of optics that work on the telescope. And I have where my position is on the Earth. And I have how the Earth rotates. And I have how my timepieces work. And how they're related to where I'm looking at. I'm not just testing the theory about the star. I'm testing my theory of optics and my theory of the machinery in the telescope and my theory of my watch and all of it. All of it goes together to the test. Now, if it fails, how do I know which part to reject? This problem goes back to Pierre Duhem in the 19th century, who was a great French philosopher of science. Popper's theory is hopeless. It's hopeless. And it's been known to be hopeless for 5 decades. And people spout it as if it were gospel. It's just not true. Now, where does this come up for us? Let's suppose I predict something that can happen. I don't say it will happen for sure. And I say it's very likely to happen. This guy has mental powers. If he thinks about it hard enough, he can figure out what you think. What could be done to falsify it? He guesses what you're thinking and gets it wrong. So well, I said he wasn't thinking about it hard enough. That's why he got it wrong. See? So you could never falsify it. Now, a person who believes in Popper will say, you can't falsify, it's not scientific, and it has no content, no value, no nothing. Okay, suppose he tries 3 times to figure out what you're thinking, and the 3rd time he gets it. Is that worth knowing? Is that something you should take account of? Did you worry about what you think when he's a man? Or should you say, listen, to keep him fortified, it's not scientific. It's just garbage. It has no content whatsoever. Let's take guessing the closing Dow Jones Industrials Average. I say Charlie is the kind of guy, if he thinks about it hard enough, he can guess the closing Dow Jones Industrials. So he tries for tomorrow and gets it wrong. And I say, well, he didn't think hard enough. So you can never prove me wrong. But suppose in the next 10 days he gets 3 out of the 10 right. Is that going to impress you? It won't impress you. Because if he were like everybody else, he should never get it right. Never. To the hundredth place. If he gets 3 out of 10 right, something very special is going on here, even though you could never falsify. Even though you could never falsify. So falsifiability, the idea that if I float an idea, I have to prove to you there's a way to show that it could be false, is simply wrong. It's simply wrong. It's not a correct description of how science works. Yeah.
So there's a subtlety there, right? He's prophesizing the Dow Jones Industrial Average, right? He got it right. And he got it right within a finite period of time. So he said to you, at some point the Dow Jones Industrial Average is going to hit 86.43. Okay. When? Right. Throughout history, they never hit that.
That's right, but if it hits next week, you'll be shocked.
That's prophecy, right.
So why?
If you get something right within a finite period of time, it's prophecy. If you just say something general, like, oh, it's going to hit 86.
No. Suppose he says it will hit 86.43 sometime, and he doesn't give any time limit whatsoever.
That's meaningless, right? That's meaningless.
I don't think so, because suppose it hits it next week.
Suppose it doesn't.
That's not the point. The point is, to disqualify hypothesis, you have to show that it's meaningless, it has no effect, no matter what happens. Now, I'm giving you a scenario in which, if someone says that it will hit 86.3, and gives no time limit whatsoever, and it hits next week, against all expectation, you're still going to think there's something funny about him. You're not going to say that because it wasn't falsifiable, that it's meaningless that he said it. Because you don't think it should ever come true. Suppose a person says that a person's going to flip a coin and it's going to land on the edge and sit there and balance on the edge. He said, well, you know, I suppose that's theoretically possible, but it should never happen. Suppose it happens within an hour of when he says it. You'll be very impressed. Even though he didn't give a time limit on it.
But if you flip the coin, it's going to land on heads. That's not impressive, right? Because
it's
expected. It's within the range of expected
that's right.
behavior.
That's right.
It's the ability to predict something completely unexpected, having it happen at some point.
Even though he hasn't put a time limit on it.
He hasn't exactly put a time limit on it.
Which means that it's not falsifiable. And even though it's not falsifiable, it's definitely a prediction that shows that he has some insider information that other people don't have. That's what I'm talking about. It doesn't have to be falsifiable. Prophecy theory is wrong. It's a mistake. So it's very widespread. And what's frustrating for me as a person is that I learned the mistake in graduate school in the early 1960s, and everybody's spouting it as if it were the gospel. In the year 2003. It's just very frustrating. This, of course, doesn't get at me.
Who's everybody?
Well, scientists, yes, say, will tell you that that's what they're doing. Here, you have a big problem, because the person who does something is not always the best person to tell you how he does it. You don't know how you balance when you ride a bike. You haven't got the foggiest idea. Most of you don't even know where the balance organs are. They're in the middle ear. Nobody knew that until 100 years ago. Nobody had any idea how people balance. We're very good at doing the balancing. We're not very good at describing it. A baseball player doesn't always make a good baseball coach. Because having the talent to play is not the same as having the talent to describe and train others to play. Those are two separate talents. Science is one subject. Philosophy of science is a different subject. Scientists are not necessarily trained to describe what they do and explain how they do it. Many scientists will tell you that they use simplicity because it pleases them. It's just beautiful, right? Why should I rely on beauty to make predictions of what the real world will do? You come up with a definite line. They can tell you what's beautiful about it, they can tell you which ones to pick, but they can't explain to you why they're picking it. Because that's philosophy, it's not science. My trouble is, people don't distinguish the subjects clearly, and they think, I ask the scientists, you know, who should know better about science than a scientist? Because of what you mean about. If you mean about doing science is one thing. You mean why you do it that way and how you do it that way, and what the explanation for it is, that's philosophy, it's not science. Is that no better that than bus drivers are?
Yeah. Were you going to go into, like, you know how we got off track? So yeah. Are we missing, like, some good stuff that you were going to go into?
Well, the subject of today was secular challenges to free will. I did some of them. And tomorrow I'm going to do religious challenges. And that material we didn't miss it. But I did want to talk more about chaos theory, more about Penrose. And that just got lost.
We're going to get into that right before we get into that. Just by the end of 10 minutes. But a question about probability and what's more likely as far as theory of mind is concerned, as far as what we know. You say that the mind might not be contained within the brain, but as far as probably contained within the brain.
Let me say this again, because it's hard to get this point across. Listen. You're barking up the wrong tree. You're barking up the wrong tree. Let me try to give you the flavor of what's going on here. Suppose we ask, why do people commit murders? And someone says, the answer is rhododendrons. How probable is that? Is it a probable hypothesis? An improbable hypothesis?
You can't place a
probability. It isn't a hypothesis. It's just, it's apples and oranges. Rhododendrons is why people commit murder. I mean, there's just no connection between them. It's not in the same ballpark. I don't know what you mean when you say rhododendrons is why people, you know why people commit murders? Because Beethoven, or because hexagons, or because full moons, or, I don't know what the connection is supposed to be. Where do they come from? Now, if somebody says that the mind might be the brain, I don't know what the suggestion means. It's not yet ready for probability. It's like saying that the number 6 is goldfish.
Okay, now, so
I mean, there is a big problem with numbers.
Here's where
let me try it with numbers. Maybe this will make sense to some people. Numbers is a big problem. I wrote a book on this. What is the number 3? Where is the number 3? How much does number 3 weigh? What size is it? What color is it? What shape is it? It just doesn't sound the right kind of question to ask about the number 3. Numbers are just different, They're just different. They aren't physical objects, numbers aren't. Okay, so then, how do we know anything about them? Seems we know things about the world by looking, touching, feeling, doing experiments. Mathematics, you don't have that kind of thing. Now, I suppose someone said, I have a solution to this problem. The number 3 really is the Eiffel Tower. Once you realize that, everything will come out okay. So, I don't know for sure. How probable is it? How probable is it that the number 3 is the Eiffel Tower? I don't know what those words mean. I don't know how to take the number and make it into a physical object. We started with the problem that numbers aren't physical objects. You can't just say, well, my solution is the number 3 is the Eiffel Tower. I don't know what you're talking about. Probability doesn't come into it. Evidence doesn't come into it. Theorizing. Technology, let's get an electromicroscope to do it, or a super electromicroscope to do what? To look at what? Look very closely at the Eiffel Tower to find the number 3 inside? I mean, the words don't describe a thought yet ready for discussion or investigation. Now, somebody says conscious experience is in the brain. He says, if you look deeply enough into the neutron, into the neurons, and look at how they're wired, you're going to see a pain or the taste of orange soda, or you're going to see the thought that the earth is round rather than flat. I don't know what those words mean. That's by saying the number 3 is the Eiffel Tower. The brain isn't the candidate for finding pains inside. At least so far as we think of what pains are and think of what the brain is, there's no connection between them. Somebody asked me how probable it is. It's like asking me how probable is it the number 3 is the Eiffel Tower. It's just not the right kind of place built for the sort of thing.
I don't know why, in the sense that I understand what you're saying about the numbers and everything else, but I mean, as far as the neurons firing within the brain, there can be an infinite, you know, infinite number of patterns, which would create an infinite number of experiences.
And there's an infinite number of combinations of molecules in the Eiffel Tower. So surely that swirl of combinations, I could find the number three, couldn't it? Why not? There's so many of them, and they combine in so many different ways. There's so many different patterns. But you see, the patterns of molecules in the Eiffel Tower are the wrong sort of category to look for the number three in. It's not a question of having lots and lots of them.
But you don't know that about consciousness.
Well,
you don't know for a fact that that's the wrong thing to look for consciousness.
Do I know for a fact that the number three isn't in the Eiffel Tower? How do I know that fact?
The concept of the number three.
Well, so far, the concept of pain is the kind of concept that isn't found in neurons. That's the right kind of concept. So I don't know it. I don't know. There's nothing here to know. It's the wrong kind of... Go back to the zombie. What is wrong with this picture of someone who's wired exactly like I am and it doesn't have any experiences?
Well, they don't exist.
Tell me what's wrong with it.
They don't exist,
The question is not whether they exist or not. The question is whether there's any contradiction in the description. Where is there a contradiction in saying that there's something which is wired exactly like I am and doesn't have any experiences? Wow. Indeed, the problem of other minds is that you don't know that I really do have experiences. Well, if so, then you have to admit it's possible from where you stand that my brain exists without experiences. It's possible for you that I'm a zombie. So then there's nothing wrong with the picture of a zombie. No contradiction to the picture of a zombie. Indeed, you don't even know how it's not true. So now I ask you, what is the probability that the pains are in my brain? You don't even know whether there's any pains in my brain at all.
There's no reason to believe it's anywhere else. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, but that's not a good reason to thinking that it's over here. A process of elimination. Suppose somebody said, look, all I know is there's a physical world, so the numbers have to be physical. So there's no reason to say it's not an Eiffel Tower. Because I only recognize the physical world. I don't know, if I turn it upside down and say if number three can't be the Eiffel Tower or anything else, then you've got to say there's more than the physical world. Because you can't put the number three in it. Yeah.
Then, if the mind isn't somehow connected to the physical processes of the brain...
I didn't say it wasn't connected. I said it wasn't identical.
Okay, if the mind...
It definitely is connected. Not everybody takes for granted. Stop the guy in the head, he doesn't feel anything. Everybody knows that.
Okay, if the mind isn't stored within the
brain... There's another word that we don't know what it means, stored. It isn't identical with the brain. That's what I'm claiming. At least... So far, we don't know what it would mean to say that it's identical, just like we don't know what it would mean to say that number three is the Eiffel Tower. The mind is related to the brain the way the number three is to the Eiffel Tower. It just don't belong. Now, maybe someone will figure out a way of reconceiving everything and changing the way we think about things. That has happened in the past. We reconceive space, we reconceive time, we reconceive motion, we reconceive lots of things. What's very good?
That is likely. That's what I mean. That is likely. Yeah. In the sense that all we can see is things going into the brain, things coming out of the brain, you know, neurons firing in and out of the brain. That's all we can see. So that is what's likely. That's an likely scenario is what I'm saying.
Yeah, likely. I mean, you can't put probabilities on new discoveries. Either it'll be discovered or it won't be discovered. There are problems in philosophy that are 2,000 years old. You can't put a probability on the problem being solved. This is one of those problems. Free will is another problem. There are a bunch of problems which have been around for a couple of thousand years, and maybe they will be solved, and maybe they won't. Yeah.
I'm trying to say this. You can't say that the program running in your computer is something abstract that doesn't exist inside the computer. Because even though it's being processed one bit at a time, it's still running on the computer.
Yes. Now, here's what people say. I'll tell you what people usually say about this. You have computers that run on somewhat different hardware. There was the old UNIVAC, which built, you know, a big auditorium with vacuum tubes and all that kind of stuff. Now you have your PC. I would say they're running the same program. You have light switches. It used to be physical transistors, now you have light switches and so on and so on. So now when we say it's the same program on different hardware, what do we mean? See, here's where people say, well, the program is an abstract thing, like a number. It's a pattern. Right? It's a pattern of interactions. Now, you can make the pattern of interactions out of plastic, you can make the pattern of interactions out of silicon, you can make the pattern of interactions out of light switches. It's all the same pattern, even though the hardware is different. So when you talk like that, then the pattern is really something abstract, like a number.
And it is realized in this hardware and that hardware and that hardware. And we talk about numbers that way also. The number 3 is realized in this triplets, and it's realized in the coins in my pocket, and it's realized in the cars that so-and-so owns, and it's number 3 is realized in, I don't know, wherever you have trios, right? But the number's abstract, and it's realized in these various physical structures.
So it's safe to say that the mind is a pattern. So
this is what people wanted to say. People wanted to say that the mind is a wholly abstract thing. It's the pattern of the interactions that are taking place. Now, this is really weird, because if you say that, you're admitting that the mind is not a physical thing. This was supposed to be the scientific version. This was supposed to be the physical version. This was supposed to be the materialist version. The computer program isn't the physical thing. The computer is a physical thing, but the computer program isn't a physical thing. So already, people like Chomsky are accusing that school of being dualists. Okay, they aren't the same dualists as Descartes. You know, the mind isn't the soul. It isn't a different substance. But it's an abstract pattern, which isn't a physical thing. That ought to make scientific people feel a little uncomfortable.
It can only be actualized in one way, within the frame.
Oh, but yes, so, I'd rather. Then the very same program that is my mind can be actualized in a computing machine or in somebody else's brain, and they'll be the exact same mind. It'll be actualizations of the same mind. Some people are nervous about that. You know, two people could have the same mind because they're running the same pattern of interactions, right? That also makes people kind of nervous. But here you have John Searle's argument. The Chinese room argument, which is designed to show that no computer, as a computer, could be a mind, could think, could understand anything. It's again apples and oranges. Now, I'll give you this argument, and then we'll quit for today. It's a lot of philosophy in mind for one day. What do computers do? Computers take physical entities or physical events and transform them into other physical things. And they do it by their physical properties alone. You send in a certain electrical voltage, and then it meshes around for a while and sends out another electrical voltage. A computer takes a physical thing, and on the basis of some of its physical characteristics, transforms it into another physical thing with other physical characteristics and sends it out. That's what a computer does. Okay, now let's ask, does the computer understand? Let's suppose the computer does arithmetic. Does it understand addition, multiplication, division? Let's suppose the computer is one of these now rudimentary translating programs. To translate English into French, and I'm internet, you press a button, translate this page, and translate it into some other language. Does the computer understand English and French well enough so that it translates from one to the other by understanding? Is that what's going on? Here's Searle's argument that can't be right. Searle says, imagine a person who is hired to do a job. And here's his job. He's in a room, and in one slot come pages with Chinese symbols on them. Those are like chicken tracks, you know, those designs, those decorations. Now he has a book of rules. And the book of rules says, if your piece of paper has this decoration and this decoration and that decoration and this order so forth and so on, then you are to take blocks, which have those other decorations on them, and put them in a simple order on a tray, and then hand them out the out slot. The in slot comes in a paper with tracks. He looks up the book of rules, which says, for this track, put that track, put that track, put that track. And then he hands out a tray with the arrangement of tracks that the rules set to do. Right? He just follows it on the basis of the shapes of the tracks. Just like a computer would. Now, unbeknownst to our friend who's employed to do this, the pages coming in are requests for the times of the departure of trains from the train station. And the trays of symbols that he's putting out are the information when the trains are leaving for the train station. This is all going on in Chinese. Right? because he's an American who's never seen Chinese before. Now, this arrangement, the paper's coming in, he with his book of rules, looking at the chicken tracks, and putting out the blocks with more of these chicken tracks on the tray, and hanging them out, is giving information about the departure of trains. But, says Searle, the guy who's doing it doesn't understand anything. He doesn't understand Chinese. He doesn't understand trains. He doesn't understand the departures. He's just, taking these shapes as inputs and giving those shapes as outputs. Now, that's all a computer does. It takes a physical object as an input, and on the basis of its physical properties alone, it transforms it into another physical object as an output. Of course, when I put the physical object in, I say it's numbers. And when I look at the shapes to come out, I say they're numbers. But the computer doesn't know that. Any more than the guy in the Chinese room knows that. He knows nothing. All he knows is these are the shapes and he knows what's going on. Well, this argument has attracted a whole industry of objections and replies. Some people say, well, that's only because, you see, the person doing the job doesn't have all the materials in him, right? The book is outside of him and the symbols are outside of him. So that's why the understanding isn't there. So Searle says, let him memorize the book. Let him memorize the book. So when the things come in, he looks at them, he thinks of this one, that one, oh, here, change that one, that. Turn it upside down, turn it inside out, put another polka dot in, correct, okay, and that's what it's supposed to look like, and he puts me out. So he still doesn't understand anything. He's doing it all in his head. Right? It means that knowing the physical properties of the shapes doesn't give you understanding, because understanding depends upon the meanings of the shapes. And the meanings are not determined by the physical properties of the shape. There's nothing in the sound chair which means that it's going to refer to this rather than that, or rather than Beethoven's specificity. Chair isn't inherently linked to thing to sit on. It's all conventional. The meaning resides beyond the physical shape of the symbol. If all the computer gets is the physical shape of the symbol, it understands nothing. Which means, if we understand, then we're doing more than what computers do. Now, he's not a mystic, Searle. He's a hard-headed scientist. He's anti-religious, and that means everything he says is objective and true and right and perfect, But instead, in your brain, you have meat. And it is the properties of the meat that go beyond its ability to transform the physical shapes of things that give it the understanding. You're a meat machine. You're not a digital computer. Digital computer is too primitive a kind of machine to understand. Then, of course, the objection will be, but don't we model thinking processes on the computer? And the answer is, of course you do. But don't confuse modeling something with reproducing it. You can model a storm on the computer too, but the computer doesn't get wet. Right? A model of a storm is not a storm. A model of thinking is not thinking. Sure, you can model it, but modeling something and reproducing it are two entirely different things. We're asking not whether the computer can model thinking, we're asking whether the computer thinks. The answer to that question is no. Capital N, capital O, period. Yeah.
So a good question then is, does there exist an algorithm that, if running on the proper hardware, is indistinguishable from the human mind?
If you had such a thing, it would only be a simulation. It wouldn't be itself.
The question you pose mathematically is to say, because we look for the algorithm, but you first want to say, can I show that such an algorithm exists before I go looking for it?
No, you couldn't show that it does exist. What you might be able to do is show that it doesn't exist. That's what Penrose basically claims he's done. Penrose claims, on the basis of Gödel's theorem, that he's shown that there can't be such an algorithm.
So no Turing test will ever be passed.
Correct.
Well, that's great, because that sort of...
Well, his proof is controversial. His proof is controversial, right.
But that hasn't been proven wrong?
No. Well, some people say it has, but then he has replies to them, so it's very controversial.
From our perspective, it has been proven and decided. The guy made a mistake, he fixed it, so where...
No, you have to understand, this is not pure mathematics, this is applied mathematics. And in applied mathematics, the debate can go on forever. It's not like pure mathematics. Pure mathematics, you've got to prove it's usually accepted by everybody. But in applied mathematics, whether it applies to the reality accurately, that's the crucial issue. Yeah.
We've been using lots of analogies tonight, like all about the computer and Chinese, and the three with power. And I've just been thinking in my mind a certain analogy that I haven't been able to quite solidify. Maybe if I just like transfer you, maybe you can, maybe like a painter, like using paint to paint a picture. Like the actual paint is not the picture. Like the mind is not the brain. I don't know. If I'm just way off.
The picture is a good example now. I think the paint is the picture. If somebody burns the Mona Lisa, it's not as if the picture survives. The picture's gone.
But the idea of the picture.
They didn't paint the idea, they painted the picture.
Okay.
In the arts, you have a fundamental distinction. This is what I call, like my graduate school, between an art object, which is a single entity, and an art object which can be realized over and over and over again. Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Okay. What is it? You perform it over and over and over again. You stop performing it, has it ceased to exist? No, there are copies in the library. And have you burned all the copies in the library? Have you destroyed Beethoven's Fifth Symphony? It's a funny. One of my professors, Nelson Goodman, wrote a whole book on this called Languages of Art. I mean, this and other subjects as well. I'll leave you with a thought, since I mentioned him. I'll leave you with a thought. You know, there are people who paint copies of paintings. One of the famous paintings, he paints a copy. The painting is worth $25 million, and this copy is worth $100. Let's imagine someone who's so good a copyist that when you look at his copy, you can't tell the copy from the original. Is there any reason to prefer the original?
Of course.
Okay. I saw some head shaking yes and some head shaking no. So you can tell.
I did that even. The ritual is sounding fun, that somebody found this unique.
There's been things in history that have been burned, right?
Okay.
They don't have it anymore. So, do you know that
he's still recording? Right. This baseball bat was one of my favorite computer games.